Welcome back to the Q Files. On this week's episode, we're going to get our hands dirty, digging up the dead. It's not an often thought of or spoken about process, but exhumation happens more than many of us may realize. Exhumation is most often done to simply relocate a body for non-nefarious purposes. Families moving a loved one to a more special place, a place that's closer to home, or even so they can be with other loved ones. But there are also times when we disturb the dead's sleep for less romantic reasons, to determine a cause of death, to determine identification itself, or even grave robbing.
There's also notable historical examples of bodies being exhumed for posthumous execution, dissection, and gibbeting, which are all sort of related. The idea behind them is that no one can escape justice, not even in death. And if you're anything like me, I was less familiar with the term gibbeting or gibbet. But it's a structure from which the dead or sometimes dying bodies of criminals would be placed hanged for public display to deter others from committing crimes. There's history and a cultural significance to leaving the dead to rest in peace. Around the world and throughout time, different people and cultures have all had ceremony and respect for the deceased. This eventually turns into taboos around disturbing the dead. We see this today, frequently played out with construction companies. A new building is planned, and as construction progresses, human remains are found.
Whether that is like here in Columbus, where the North Market sits on top of the Old North Cemetery and remains are periodically discovered during construction, renovation, or expansion, or with Native American burial sites across the United States. In some places, remains are even periodically but respectfully disturbed to, in essence, condense them, but the culture around it is serious, respectful, and done to further care for deceased loved ones.
Even more broadly, many religions forbid the practice of exhumation as it can disturb the person in the afterlife. Some Native American tribes believe moving remains unsettles the spirit. In the Jewish faith, disinterment is forbidden outside of rare exceptions, namely to be reburied in Israel. Some Christians believe that if a person's body is disturbed or destroyed, they may not be able to be resurrected. In Islam, folks are discouraged from opening, handling, or reusing graves until there are no traces of the original corpse left. In many countries, the dirt itself can be considered remains that must be handled with respect and care. But even with an underlying respect for the dead and hallowed ground, the idea of digging up the dead, removing them from what should be their final resting place, has been a source of legend, lore, and spooky entertainment for pretty much of all recorded history.
Fantastical stories have been woven about the curse of King Tut's tomb, the stitched together remains in Frankenstein. Even zombies, springing out of the ground in a form of reanimated life, have filled the popular imagination with metaphors, omens of infection, climate change, and racism. There has also been a plethora of famous exhumations, most done through rather unsavory means. Jesse James, the infamous outlaw, died in 1882, but rumors persisted for years that his death was faked, staged by members of his posse. In 1948, a 100-year-old man, J. Frank Dalton, asserted that he was the real Jesse James and gave new life to this legend. Finally, in 1995, the descendants of James exhumed his body for a DNA test, which confirmed that the corpse in Kearney, Missouri was, in fact, the real Jesse James.
Abraham Lincoln fell victim to grave robbers in 1876. A Chicago gang of counterfeiters launched a scheme to pry Lincoln's body from his tomb in Springfield, Illinois. They planned to hold the corpse for ransom, wanting $200,000 and the release of their best engraver from prison. They were stopped by law enforcement mid-act. But this resulted in Lincoln's body being moved to various unmarked graves until in 1901, when he was finally encased in a steel cage and entombed under 10 feet of concrete in the same cemetery. Christopher Columbus didn't stop making news upon his death in 1506. Rather, the great raper and pillager was buried in Spain, then moved to Hispaniola in 1542. In 1795, the Spanish dug him back up after the French captured the island and they moved him to Cuba. Eventually, he was moved back to Spain after the Spanish-American War in 1898. However, an enduring mystery remains about his remains. In 1877, a box with human remains, engraved with his name, was discovered inside the Santo Domingo Cathedral where Columbus was interred in 1542. Now, no one is exactly sure if Columbus's remains are in the Old World or the New. Serves the bastard right.
There's even curious cases in folklore and mythology. The legendary King Arthur has been exhumed and studied, but perhaps more notably for us in this episode is the curious case and discovery of what I'll call the New England vampires. In the early 19th century, think around 1800 or so, New England was suffering through a significant outbreak of consumption, tuberculosis. At the time, consumption was thought to be caused by the deceased consuming the life of their still living relatives. Bodies were exhumed and the remains of their internal organs were removed, specifically the heart, and ritually burned to stop the vampire from attacking the local population and to prevent further spread of disease. In some cases, these were celebratory public affairs.
These events stoked national fear at the time, with notable cases and stories for another day, like that of Mercy Brown in Rhode Island or Frederick Ransom in Vermont. There is an alarming number of these cases, and they continued for a while. Henry David Thoreau wrote in a journal of a vampire event in Vermont, describing the ritual burning in 1859. And I mean, Mercy Brown was in 1892, and they weren't confined to New England. There are cases in Ohio and at least as far west as Minnesota. But why is there importance here and not just a curious historical tidbit? Well, because we're still exhuming vampires. These graves and cemeteries are often old and in some cases lost. So we have events like in Griswold, Connecticut in 1990, where some kids were out playing and found a few bones. One of them barred a skull to take home. The police obviously were called, and they believe it's the work of a serial killer, Michael Ross. But as they're working the crime scene, they realize this is an old colonial-era farm cemetery. Archaeologists are called.
As the excavation and exhumation continues, they discover that there are two stone crypts among several other graves. The archaeologist, Nick Bellantani, describes working on the crypt. They slowly dig away at it. They lift a large, flat rock of the roof and uncover a red-painted coffin and a pair of skeletal feet. Upon removing another stone, they discover that the remains have been rearranged. The skeleton was beheaded. The skull and thigh bones were resting atop the ribs and vertebrae, like a skull and crossbones motif. The remains would become known as JB, his initials, and it is believed that he was ritually rearranged during the 1830s as part of a vampire scare. While his final resting place has been periodically disturbed since his death, he remains of note because he is likely the only intact archaeological clue to the vampire scare of the time.
And there is an even more troubling history to add to these tales. And it is a story of battered, beaten, mutilated African-American bodies being dug up from their graves years after their deaths to stand witness at the trials of their own white murderers. Medgar Evers was a pioneering civil rights activist in Mississippi in the 1950s and 60s. Born in Mississippi in 1925, he lived on a small farm owned by his family. Evers and his four siblings would have to walk 12 miles to attend segregated schools. However, Evers would graduate with honors. He would serve in World War II from 1943 to 1945 and even fought at the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944. Upon coming home, he would enroll at the Alcorn Agricultural and Mechanical College and marry his sweetheart, Merle. They would have three children together, Daryl, Rena, and James, or Van, Evers.
In 1954, following the Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education that said school segregation was unconstitutional, Evers would apply to the state-supported University of Mississippi, but was rejected because of his race. His attempts at enrollment would become a test case for the NAACP, the case headed up by Thurgood Marshall himself. In November of 1954, Evers was named as the NAACP's first field secretary for Mississippi and moved to Jackson with his family.
And he got to work immediately. He organized boycotts against white downtown store owners who would not allow blacks at their lunch counters. He fought for voting rights and led voter registration drives in a state that demanded that a black voter registrant fill out a 22-page questionnaire. Many African Americans at that time could not read or write. White registrants merely had to sign their names. He led fights to integrate the buses, the public parks, and the beaches. He helped James Meredith to enroll in the University of Mississippi and be the first black man admitted in 1962. And although Meredith survived, Evers would not live to see him shot by a white gunman in 1966. Evers was charismatic, direct, and determined, and some of his speeches were now even being covered on national television. He was putting a big, broad spotlight on the desperate plight of black Americans in Mississippi, and by implication, all of black America. As you can imagine, well, that didn't sit well with the white people of good old Mississippi.
After the Brown v. Board Supreme Court decision in 1954, white supremacist groups sprouted up in Mississippi, even more than existed before, and especially in Jackson. Then known as citizens' councils, they would resist desegregation in schools and public facilities and revolt against the notion of black civil rights loudly, publicly, and violently. Many of the members were also members of the Ku Klux Klan, and of course, they had set their sights on Medgar Evers. On the evening of May 28, 1963, a Molotov cocktail was thrown onto the Evers family carport. On June 7th, Evers was nearly run down by a car as he exited the NAACP office. They were coming for him.
In the early morning of June 12th, after President John F. Kennedy had just hours before gone on national television with his civil rights address, Evers pulled his car onto his driveway and then exited. He was carrying in his arms NAACP t-shirts that read, "Jim Crow must go." Suddenly, a single shot rang out and a bullet from an Enfield 1917 rifle ripped through his back and through his heart. He staggered and managed to drag himself 30 feet to the door of his family home. Merle, after telling the children to drop and stay on the floor, they had been trained for this long ago, found her nearly dead husband on their doorstep. He was taken by ambulance to a whites-only Jackson hospital that initially refused to admit him until finding out who he was. Evers would be the first black man ever treated at that hospital. What a horrific achievement. He died 1 hour later.
Merle would say of that night that all she wanted was a machine gun to mow down every white person she saw. She would remark of the absolute hate that she had in her heart in those moments. However, Merle herself would become a powerful activist for civil rights and particularly for nonviolent protest. Evers was buried at Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors on June 19, 1963. 5,000 people, led by Dr. Martin Luther King, marched through Jackson in memory of the slain leader. Police and riot gear turned the protest violent, but the crowd refused the provocation, including Merle. The day after the murder, a Jackson police detective used a stick to fish the Enfield 1917 rifle from a bramble of honeysuckle vines across from Evers' home. On it were the fingerprints of Byron De La Beckwith, a local white supremacist and Jackson Citizen Council member. Beckwith was arrested, but claimed that the gun had been stolen from him. When Beckwith's case went to trial in 1964, the jury was unable to reach a verdict. A retrial later that year resulted in another deadlocked jury. Both juries were made up of entirely white men. Blacks could not serve on juries in a white trial in Mississippi in 1964. Beckwith went free.
But Merle was not having it. But she had to bide her time. In 1994, she convinced Mississippi State Prosecutor Bobby DeLofter to reopen the case again. He agreed, but immediately realized he had a big problem. The original autopsy on Medgar Evers had been performed in 1963 by Dr. Forrest Bradley, and he claimed to have examined the body when it was still warm. He determined that the cause of death was from hemorrhage, caused by a bullet that left a dime-sized entrance wound 10 inches below the right shoulder of Evers and pierced his heart. However, the autopsy itself had never been introduced as evidence in the first two trials. And now, in 1994, DeLofter found that not only was the autopsy record missing, but so was the 1917 Enfield rifle and the bullet that had been removed from Evers' body. DeLofter decided to call Dr. Michael Braden, New York State chief pathologist considered the most credible forensic scientist in the country. DeLofter reached Braden by phone and pleaded, "We have no autopsy, no gun, and no bullet. Can you help us?"
Dr. Braden agreed to help, but it would demand that Evers' body be exhumed from Arlington National Cemetery and brought to the Albany Medical Center in upstate New York. Merle Evers gave her consent, and it was decided that Evers' youngest son, Van, who was then 33 years old, would accompany his father's remains for the entire journey. Van had also requested that he get to view his father's body. Dr. Braden agreed, but asked that Van wait until the casket could be opened and examined by Braden first, to determine the state of his father's body and determine if viewing were appropriate. Van and the family agreed. Dr. Braden has publicly said this, "I received the sealed casket in the autopsy room at Albany Medical Center. When I opened it, the body was in perfect condition. The best condition I've ever seen in any exhumed body to be in. He looked as if his funeral was only 2 or 3 days ago." Everyone in the room gasped. His burial suit was neat and dry. He looked as if he were sleeping, not like someone that had been dead for 30 years.
He continued, "I had told the son that I would call him after the autopsy examination, but I stopped then and called him up. I asked him to come down and we prepared the autopsy room as if it were a funeral parlor. The son came in and was just transforming of the autopsy room, and there was a son who was too young to remember his father, with the same face as his dad, almost the same age now that his father was when he was murdered. And there were just tears in my eyes and were tears in the eyes of others who were in the autopsy room. It was as if God were saying, 'The dead speak for the living, and here is the proof.'"
Van was then left alone for a while with the body. He didn't really remember his father. When Evers was shot, after Merle told all of the children to hit the floor and headed up to the front door, his siblings put him in the family bathtub and closed the bathroom door, doing as they had been trained, making sure that he was safe as they headed downstairs to join their mother and essentially watch their father die on the family doorstep.
Just think about that for a minute. A 33-year-old son looking at the face of his 37-year-old father. We often fantasize about what our parents looked like when they were our age. Pictures certainly can tell the tale, but just imagine looking into the actual face of your parent, who is the same age as you are. A stunning, rare moment. Van would say, "I never got a good look at my father. To see him was as much a joyous release as the trial. I got to meet him up close, face to face." With a jury of 8 men and 4 white men, Byron De La Beckwith was finally convicted of Medgar Evers' murder and died in prison at the age of 80 in 2001. And the Evers family finally got some peace. And Van Evers got to spend some time, however peculiar and sad, with the father he had never known.
Which brings us to our next story, and they are connected. One of the big reasons that Medgar Evers had also been targeted by white supremacists was that he had called for a new investigation of the death of Emmett Till. Emmett was a 14-year-old black teenager from Chicago, lynched in Money, Mississippi in 1955, beaten, shot in the head, mutilated, and eventually found 3 days later in the Tallahatchie River. His body weighed down by a cotton gin fan blade, weighing 75 pounds, which was fastened around his neck with barbed wire. Medgar Evers and two other field workers, Ruby Hurley and Amzie Moore, track down potential witnesses to the event leading up to and including Till's abduction. They convinced several people to come forward, keeping them in protective custody when they testified at the 1955 trial of two men accused of killing Till. Then, shepherding them out of town in secrecy when the all-white jury returned a verdict of not guilty.
If you don't know who Emmett Till was, well, you should. His death ignited the civil rights uprising in the 50s and 60s, and he remains to this day an icon in the struggle for black rights, black life, and black dignity. There are still discrepancies about what exactly happened. 14-year-old Emmett Till, who was born and raised in Chicago, went on a vacation in 1955 to visit his family and great-uncle Moses Wright in Money, Mississippi, a small rural town halfway between Jackson, Mississippi and Memphis, Tennessee. On August 28th, he was accused of making advances on a white woman, Carol Bryant, at a local grocery store. The truth of the matter is that he, at most, might have whistled at her. Till's cousin, Simeon Wright, who was with him at the store, stated Till whistled at Bryant, saying, "I think Emmett wanted to get a laugh out of us or something. He was always joking around. It was hard to tell when he was serious." Regardless of what happened, in 2013, Carol Bryant herself, the supposed victim of Till's whistle, said, "Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him." It only took her 60 years to say that. And it was her husband, Roy Bryant, and his half-brother, J.W. Millam, that killed Emmett Till.
The evening after the incident at the grocery store, Bryant and Millam came to Moses Wright's house and dragged Till out of bed, declaring they were looking for the boy that did the talking. After torturing him and shooting him in the head, they dumped his weighted-down body in the Tallahatchie River, some 15 miles away. His mutilated and bloated body was found 3 days later by two boys fishing. An autopsy was not performed and Till's body was returned to Chicago and to his mother, Mamie Till Bradley. Upon arrival of the body, Bradley insisted on viewing it to make a positive identification of her son, later stating that the stench from it was noticeable two blocks away. She decided to have an open casket funeral, saying,
"Well, I knew that I could not tell people what I had seen. Number one, they wouldn't believe me. But if I had 200 or 300 witnesses, then all of us could testify to what they had done to Emmett. And I thought the world needed to know what was going on in Mississippi. And that was the only way they would know would be for me to pull the cover off and let them see, let the world see what was going on."
She wanted the world to see what two white men had done to her son. A glass cover was placed over the open coffin lid to contain the stench from Till's badly decomposed and mutilated body. And people saw. 50,000 people attended his funeral or viewed his body, and thousands more saw the photographic images published in black-owned and progressive newspapers and magazines. A rage was growing. 100 days later, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Reverend Jesse Jackson told Vanity Fair in 1988 that Rosa said she thought about going to the back of the bus, but then she thought about Emmett Till, and she couldn't do it.
But in September of 1955, an all-white jury found Bryant and Millam not guilty of Emmett Till's murder after just 67 minutes of deliberation, without either of them ever taking the stand. One juror later said, "We wouldn't have taken so long if we hadn't stopped to drink pop." David Halberstam called the trial the first great media event of the civil rights movement. Without fear of a new trial protected by double jeopardy, both men admitted to Look magazine in 1956 that they had indeed killed him. However, the trial was also noteworthy for this. Till's great-uncle Moses Wright stood up bravely in court and identified Millam as one of the men who had taken Emmett from his house. Moses Wright went down in history as maybe the first black man that stood in open court in the South and accused a white man of a crime and lived.
The FBI and the Justice Department reopened the case in 1994 because there had been no autopsy, and Bryant and Milam and the defense attorney had then claimed that the body that was found was not that of Emmett Till's. His body was exhumed in 2005 and an autopsy performed. It was determined the body was indeed that of Emmett Till, and found that Till had died of a gunshot wound to the head and that he had broken wrist bones, broken skull, and leg fractures. When his body was pulled from the Tallahatchie River in the summer of 1955, the report said, quote, "The crown of his head was just crushed out, and a piece of his skull just fell out," end quote.
Bryant and Milam were dead and could not be retried, but the prosecutor tried to make a case to indict others that were also involved, and particularly Carol Brandt, who they said had aided and abetted her husband in the murder. A Mississippi grand jury ruled that there was insufficient evidence to indict her, or anyone else, essentially closing the book on the case. Till's cousin, Simeon Wright, who was with Till in the same bed the night he was kidnapped from their granduncle's home in Money, Mississippi, said, "From what I saw, I think they had enough evidence to indict. Every last person up to now has gotten away with murder."
Emmett Till may indeed be an icon in the civil rights movement, but his murderers got away. Like almost all white murderers of black people have gotten away. For centuries. These black men were not even left in the peace of their own graves after being slaughtered, but were called upon once again to rise up and stand as a witness against their murderers with their own dead black bodies. Black lives matter, and black bodies matter too. It's time to dredge up our dark American past and then bury this intolerable racist society, for once and for all. Instead of digging up the dead, and demanding they bear witness to their own brutalization.
This show was created and produced by me, Shane McClelland, and Lori Gum. Until next time, friends, be weird, stay curious. These are the Q Files. Oh, and here's a little preview from our friends at Ghost Town.
Are you into the secret histories of exorcisms, Christmas massacres, killdozers, and concert disasters?
How about haunted mansions, the Philadelphia Experiment, the Dorm of Death, or candy corn?
Then you're gonna love Ghost Town, a hilarious and sometimes not so hilarious twice-weekly podcast.
On Wednesdays, we discuss the secret history of an abandoned, unexplored, haunted, or mysterious place from anywhere in the world.
And on Fridays, we cover an amazing historical failure from any time in history.
Ghost Town is 100% safe and legal. We guarantee it.
It's also fun, spooky, and can contain a riot,
a massacre,
a murder,
or an arch deluxe.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
I'm Jason Horton.
And this is Ghost Town. And you can find Ghost Town wherever you listen to podcasts.